and Americans for the Arts.
Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Today we'll hear from a group in Treasure Island who's trying to protect their limited green space. They oppose a plan for a dog park in their beach community. And later on, we'll talk with a journalist from The Intercept about his articles on a private company that was giving information to the Department of Homeland Security about protests against the Trump administration's family separation policy. And I want to take your calls as well. If you have an opinion about any of these topics, the number to call is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Well, our first topic here, some residents of the Pinellas County Beach community of Treasure Island are fighting back against the loss of green space in their small town. The city wants to convert the park into a dog park. And joining us on the phone right now is Glenn McKeel. He's spokesperson for Citizens Against Roselli Dog Park in Treasure Island. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, Glenn.
Well, thank you very much, Sean. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and to speak to our local residents about the chance for trying to protect our last remaining green space in this beautiful Roselli Park here in Treasure Island.
Well, not very many people, I'm guessing, would know exactly where that is or what it looks like. So why don't you tell us what the park is like and where it is?
Okay, it's located on the Isle of Capri in Treasure Island, which is about a block off of Gulf Boulevard. Again, in Treasure Island. It really is a lovely community park. It has a little league field, a batting cage, a children's play area, basketball hoop, tennis court, shuffleboard, public restroom, and some beautiful walking trails that encompass the entire park. And one of the proposal that the city has just approved will eliminate what is really tantamount to the last remaining green space in this park. They're going to destroy it.
Dog parks can be really popular. I mean, I see them in a lot of the communities that when I go around town or around the area. So, you know, are there other places for dogs to go in the Isle of Capri and in Treasure Island?
Not directly in Treasure Island. There are dog parks in Madeira Beach and St. Pete Beach. And the area that they're trying to, we say, shoehorn this small dog park into is really in the middle of a neighborhood. And again, we'll cause some real environmental concerns. To that point, if I could, the city had proposed originally placing the dog park concept on the city's park master plan. And that would open it up to review in the entire city and find a suitable location. We contend there are suitable locations that will have less environmental impact, less resident impact, one of them being right next to the Treasure Island Community Center, which is a large park that, again, has protection. But if I could just go a little further to talk about how the park came to be. And in September of 2018, the local civic association, Isle of Capri Civic Association, approached the city about setting up a small dog run of about 4,000 square feet somewhere in the Roselli Park, and they proposed raising the funds. Unfortunately, once it hit the city level, the recreation department took it and turned it into a 13,000 square foot area, which what they're now calling a signature dog park, but basically two dog parks, a large dog park area, a small dog park area, water, fencing, really a monstrosity, in our opinion, going to look like a prison camp. Problem is, the area that they've approved is a small area on the southern end of the park that has really the only green space. There are 8 large cypress trees there. There are nesting for ospreys that have been there for years that are going to be impacted or displaced. The area is home to a green parrot nesting area and other squirrels and wildlife that will really be destroyed. So they're basically taking what's left of a small area and destroying the green space. And lastly, if I could say, yes, we're not anti-dog park. We think dog parks are a wonderful concept when planned properly, when placed properly, and when considering everything, especially environmental concerns.
Our guest is Glenn McKeel, a spokesperson for Citizens Against Roselli Dog Park in Treasure Island. And this is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. My name is Sean Canaan. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint. And so, Glenn, that green space that the city wants to turn into a dog park, what do you use it for now? You mentioned some of the wildlife that's there, but how do residents use that space?
It's a beautiful area that's, again, encircled by a walking trail. So it gives folks, there are some benches there to enjoy, to sit, to take in nature, to enjoy the breeze, to get out of the sun. And that's really the area that the reason the dog park folks want it there is because it'll be protected by shade with these 8 large cypress trees. But, you know, we contend in all the research that we have done, those trees will become destroyed by pet urine and pet waste and runoff. Another big concern is the potential for environmental runoff from the pet waste area that our storm drains drain directly into the Gulf, and they're located 20 feet from the proposed dog park. And despite over 150 residents approaching our city officials asking for help, all but one of our city commissioners has basically turned our back on us and the environment, and it is very, very concerning.
Where are we in the process?
The park has been approved by the city at the March 19th City Commission meeting. We've asked that you put it through the proper channels, including the planning board, environmental review, local traffic impact studies, and just really plan the park properly. The city commissioners have refused all but one. We do have one ally who thinks that we really need to take a step back and plan it properly. If planned properly, including environmental impact, it will certainly have potential to do less damage and have less impact. So city has approved it. The local civic commission has to raise the funds to do it. They're estimating it's around $30,000 to put up a fence, which again is their idea of planning, is putting up a fence. And as a result of that, they've only raised about $16,000 to date. We are working right now, since the city has refused to address us at each of their commission meetings. We have been allowed to speak, but they've refused to address any of these concerns. We've been in contact with the Audubon Society. We're also working with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection to ask them to consider the wastewater runoff. And honestly, we feel so strongly and passionately about this that our group, collectively of our citizens, have gotten together, raised money, and hired an attorney to help us with our cause.
So what's the next step? What do you plan on doing next? Are there any demonstrations, or is there another board meeting that you'll be attending?
Ultimately, the final plan will have to come back before the commission. We've addressed, I believe, 3 or 4 of the city commission meetings now. We've probably gone in there with, you know, 30 or 40 people at each of these commission meetings, and over a dozen people have spoken, honestly, on both sides for and against the dog park. Again, falling on deaf ears. So we're reaching out. We're asking anyone that would like to learn more about this or become interested, if you would contact us, and at the appropriate time, I'll give you our email address if someone would like to email us. But in answer to your question, yes, it will be going back for a final commission vote to approve the design. The park is approved. Now it's just to approve the design, unless there's some intervening factors such as our potential work with the attorney to try and either slow this down or have them consider all of the impact of it.
Well, before I ask for the email address so that people can get in touch with you if they're interested, is there anything else about this potential dog park on Treasure Island that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, again, we're not anti-dog park. We're not anti-citizen. We're not anti-pet. We're all about, you know, planning and process and doing it properly, protecting our green space, protecting our environment, just, you know, take the right steps, do the right analysis so that things can be done properly, and we can all peacefully coexist.
Well, Glenn McKeel with Citizens Against Roselli Dog Park, what is the best way for people to get in touch with you if they're interested?
If folks would like more information, you could email us at nodogpark@protonmail.com. And I'll say that again and spell it. nodogpark@protonmail.com. It's nodogpark@protonmail.com. And either Georgia, Brad, or myself, or three organizers here would be glad to answer any questions anyone had and keep you up to date on our dates for approval and what our next steps will be, either in the approval process or the litigation process.
Well, Glenn, thanks so much for coming on WMNF's Midpoint. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Sean. And if anybody does want to contact us, we'd love to hear from anyone.
Great. Thanks for coming on the show. Glenn McKeel is a spokesperson for Citizens Against Roselli Dog Park in Treasure Island. They also go by the acronym CARD-P. And we'll be right back after this short music break. We're going to hear about a new report in The Intercept online journal where a private company gave information about protests to the Department of Homeland Security. I think you'll be interested in this interview. And you can call in 813-239-9663 with your thoughts. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:17 in the afternoon. This is 88.5. We'll be right back. Now to immigration protests. Last summer, there were massive demonstrations all across the country, including here in the Tampa Bay area, against the Trump administration's policy of separating families at the border. And our next guest, Ryan Devereaux, writes for The Intercept. He published information about a private company that collected information about those protests and gave that information to the Department of Homeland Security. So I'm going to play my interview with The Intercept's Ryan Devereaux. And if you'd like to weigh in, you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885 or call and be first in the queue. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. Here is The Intercept's Ryan Devereaux.
Our reporting shows that last year, amid nationwide protests against the Trump administration's policy of family separation, private intelligence firm known as Looking Glass Solutions gathered information on those protests, a total of more than 600 protests, according to internal emails. They sent that information to a network of state-level law enforcement fusion centers, which sort of exist to disseminate information to other law enforcement entities across the country. So information made its way to the Department of Homeland Security's intelligence office, where it was further disseminated to DHS staff and eventually to ICE agents in the field. And what the story shows is a sort of sweeping collection of information on demonstrations against one of the Trump administration's most controversial immigration policies.
Last summer, there were a lot of protests about this family separation policy by the Trump administration. And so the Department of Homeland Security got this information from this private company, and they tell you that it was unsolicited.
Yeah, that's correct. So the Department of Homeland Security provided us with a response for this story that was very interesting. DHS told us that this information was unsolicited. So that's the word that they used. That this company basically sent it in, And because the information contained in there included protests around federal facilities, DHS said it was obligated to disseminate this information to state-level law enforcement fusion centers around the country. Later, in a subsequent story we published, which reported that Senator Elizabeth Warren's office had sent a letter to DHS's Inspector General's office asking for investigation, DHS told us that not only was this information unsolicited, but that Looking Glass Solutions didn't have a contract with DHS, which raises even more questions, because what we're essentially being told here is that a private intelligence firm can gather information from social media on First Amendment free speech protected activity, send it to the Department of Homeland Security without a contract with the agency, and DHS will disseminate that information. In fact, it feels that it is required to disseminate that information. You can sort of understand the concerns this raises. If a private intelligence company is gathering information on First Amendment free speech protected activity and is sending it even without a contract to DHS, and DHS believes that it has to disseminate that information, that could lead us into some troubling areas.
And one of the reasons that the Department of Homeland Security gave you for saying it was required to disseminate that information is because some of the protests were near federal buildings, but a lot of these protests were not. They were out in the public, out in community squares, including at a high school in Sebring, Florida, which is near us.
That's correct. There's a long list, as I said, of more than 600 protests included in the information that Looking Glass collected. The information included physical addresses of where these protests were happening and times and Facebook event IDs. And then, as you mentioned, you know, some of these protests were really quite large in New York City and Washington, D.C., tens of thousands of people. But others were small, in small towns, at high schools, at churches, were demonstrations that involved, you know, families coming out and sort of making their voices heard. These weren't sort of defiant, radical protests. They were family-oriented protests that sort of major liberal organizations were involved in sort of organizing.
Our guest is Ryan Devereaux. He's with The Intercept on 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa. And Ryan, one of the groups within the Department of Homeland Security that got this information after it was disseminated by DHS were fusion centers in the different states. Remind people what fusion centers are and what their controversial history is.
After the attacks of September 11th, the U.S. government stood up this network of fusion centers as a sort of node in the war on terror. The idea was that these fusion centers would, as the name suggests, sort of pull together all of the different strands of intelligence that were circulating between law enforcement, the intelligence community, state, federal, local levels, so that people were working off a lot of the same information. In theory, it makes sense, but in practice, what these fusion centers have been shown to do is create a lot of oftentimes unvetted content. In 2012, congressional investigators took a hard look at fusion centers and sort of the funding of fusion centers and the work product that they create. And the results of that inquiry were a fairly scathing report that found uneven and often poor quality intelligence reports generated from fusion centers. At times, fusion centers and a sort of network of private companies that they work with running roughshod over civil liberties and privacy protections that private citizens are expected to enjoy, have the right to enjoy. So these centers are definitely not without their share of controversy. And then I should add that, you know, what we see here, I think that the concerning issue with this particular story, what we see is not how so much a company like Looking Glass gathered this information. That's pretty straightforward, the sort of culling of, you know, publicly posted information on Facebook. The concerning issue, to my mind, is that there's a whole industry of private intelligence companies that believe that their clients, law enforcement, federal, state, local law enforcement, has an interest in seeing that kind of information about what is protected free speech, you know, activity under the First Amendment. And those companies are right oftentimes in assuming that. We see that DHS did circulate this information. Their point being, collecting information on protests, there's a market for that among these companies' government clients.
How did you get the information that Looking Glass Cyber Solutions had provided the Department of Homeland Security with this information on protests?
It came through the result of some sort of hard-fought Freedom of Information Act litigation. The American Immigration Council and the sort of network of legal immigration advocacy organizations have been engaged in for more than a year now. So these organizations, AIC and others, have been fighting to get documents, primary source documents, surrounding the creation, implementation, and fallout of family separation. So this email chain was included somewhat randomly in comparison to other documents that they received in a sort of tranche of documents that are beginning to come back as a result of that FOIA litigation.
In the last couple of years, since the Trump administration has been in the White House, what has the history been of law enforcement agencies cracking down on critics of the Trump administration, maybe especially with regard to immigration policies?
Yeah, I think at this point, it's somewhat impossible to ignore the pattern that has emerged of exactly that phenomenon of critics of the administration's immigration policies finding themselves in the crosshairs of law enforcement. One of the most prominent examples has been playing out in southern Arizona, where volunteers with the humanitarian aid group No More Deaths had found themselves charged with crimes for leaving jugs of water in the desert where migrants are known to have died by the thousands. And in one case involving a No More Deaths volunteer that'll be heading to trial at the end of this month, we see a volunteer charged with felonies for providing food, water, and shelter to two undocumented men in January of 2018. The defendant, his name is Scott Warren, faces up to 20 years in prison. We have also seen, as The Intercept reported earlier this year, intelligence gathering operations directed at lawyers, journalists, and activists working in the San Diego, Tijuana area who have had some sort of proximity to the migrant caravans that have sort of drawn the president's anger. We revealed in February that there was a pattern of CBP officers pulling journalists, lawyers, activists into secondary screening, asking them questions about who they knew, showing them photo lineups of prominent activists. Two photojournalists were denied entry into Mexico. Two prominent immigration attorneys were removed from the country. And documents obtained by NBC San Diego later confirmed the existence of this operation that we reported on and provided a great deal of detail into just the lengths that federal law enforcement went to keep an eye on these groups and you know, not just activists, but lawyers and journalists as well.
Well, Ryan Devereaux with The Intercept, I want to thank you so much for coming on 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you heard, that was The Intercept's Ryan Devereaux, and he was talking about his couple of articles where he told us about a private company that collected information about protests and gave that information to the Department of Homeland Security, which then disseminated it to states and to field agents. And they were about, the protests were about separating families at the border. And my question to you is, were you involved in one of those protests? Did you participate or consider participating in a demonstration like that? And if so, how do you feel about that private company gathering all the information about the protests around the country and giving that to your government and then having the government act upon that information by sending it to other parts of the government so that they knew, they were aware of this information? And again, all this was in the public domain. It was essentially Facebook event pages and so forth. So it's not like secret meetings, but it's just the idea. What do you think about the idea of a private company gathering this information as if it were a useful thing for the government to have, and then the government treating it like it's something that they would be happy and have it useful to have that information? What are your thoughts? 813 239-9663. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF.org. You might be listening on the WMNF app or on 88.5. My name is Sean Canaan, and I'm the host of WMNF's Midpoint Monday. It's 12:30 in the afternoon, and we're taking your calls. I'm going to give out the number, and then we will talk some more about this. Here's the number to call if you'd like to be first on the phone, 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Well, let me read a couple of emails that have come in. Simon asks, unfortunately, I don't know the answer to this question. I looked while the interview was playing, and I can't find the article. I know what article you're referring to, but Simon says, my understanding is that the Poynter Institute had the Intercept on their unreliable list, and what Simon's talking about is a list of fake news outlets that the Poynter Institute came out with about a week ago, and we had it up on our website, and for some reason I cannot find it. And I looked on Poynter, I looked on WMNF.org, I can't find that article. I'd be really surprised if the Intercept was up there, but I have to tell you, I don't know. It's a fairly new web-based news organization. Amy Goodman had the Intercept on this morning, talking about Eric Prince and following him about what his career is doing. Very serious journalism. Jeremy Scahill. It was one of the co-founders, or at least one of the first writers for The Intercept. So I consider it a very useful and very informative news outlet. So I don't know the answer to your question, Simon. I'd be pretty shocked if it were on that list. So thank you for that email. All right, so DeMarco writes in and says that he says, this is illegal spying. And then he goes on to say, the new COINTELPRO, and he asks, is Eric Prince involved? Is he involved in... Is he involved in Venezuela? No U.S. mercenaries, no goon squads. So kind of, I guess DeMarco is linking the two Intercept articles there. So thank you for those emails. If you'd like to join us, you can email dj at wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. And if you'd like to join the people on the phone, the number is 813-239-9663. So Nick's on the air. What would you like to say, Nick? What do you think? Were you involved in any of these protests, or how do you feel about this private company gathering that information?
Okay. Well, I was Occupy Tampa. I'm Nick from Occupy Tampa. And do you remember the article that Tampa Bay Times posted about the FBI colluding to shoot with sniper rifles from buildings our community organizers for Occupy Tampa? Like, after the 29 arrests, and once we started finally getting arrests, FBI sent out emails and dispatches to the Tampa Police Department to shoot our leaders or our organizers of Occupy Tampa. And then also after the 29 arrests, they posted our names, full names, addresses, everything for the 29 people arrested during Occupy. Like, what does everybody think about that?
So you're talking about the Tampa Bay Times, which was probably called the St. Petersburg Times then. You're saying they're the ones that are have some responsibility for posting your names?
Well, it's mainly Tampa Police Department, but it's the news media leaked our personal addresses after it was already leaked that the FBI was planning, if they had to shoot organizers of the Occupy Tampa protests, which was a nonviolent movement.
Thanks for sharing that. I you know, it's been 8 years now almost, and I don't remember that one specific detail, but that, you know, I believe you, I don't remember that.
Yeah, it's you can find it on Google. Like, the FBI definitely were threatening to shoot organizers of the Occupy Tampa protest.
And how would you connect what you're saying to this idea where this private company is giving this information, public information, to the DHS, and the DHS kind of warmly received it?
Well, it's because it's all lumped together. It's Homeland Security. It's private companies like Blackwater, people gathering information, like private paramilitary companies, and also the government doing it and sharing it all with each other. And then things like this come out. It gets reported to the FBI. These can't remember the name of the centers that they used, but they have information centers.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the fusion centers that we talked about in the interview.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yes. And it's all a collusion with all of them, and they're all working together. But the plot to kill protesters if they had to is just, it's asinine in my opinion. Like, I couldn't believe that when it's a completely nonviolent protest. And it's all because of money. We were protesting the banks. We were helping the homeless. We were standing up for everyone, and they want to act like they're going to kill us or round up protesters in mass droves, which they finally started doing. So, but thank you for your time, and I'd like to get to other callers.
Nick, thanks so much for your call. That's Nick from Occupy Tampa. So thank you for that call. And if you'd like to join us, the number again is 813-239-9663. We're talking about this article that was in The Intercept. There were a couple of articles that the second one that our guest Ryan Devereaux talked about earlier was where a U.S. senator wants an investigation, an internal investigation by DHS to say, how did this all happen? Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, who's also running for president. And we have on the line. Oh, I'm not sure who this is. Hi, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Jared from Lakeland.
Hi, Jared. What's on your mind?
Man, I just, I don't like the information being used the way it has been. If this private company is giving it to the government and the government is indeed acting on it and maybe using force acting on it. But I just wonder if this is just a big, huge, unintended consequence of the internet and social media in general of if this information is technically public, it's information that's on Facebook or Instagram or wherever it's being used, then technically anybody in the public realm, even if it's a private company, has the right to use it. So I'm just wondering, again, I don't like it, but I think we have to step back and realize maybe what we're doing as far as what we're posting, how we're sending information out there. Because, again, if it's public, then technically these people have a right to use it however they see fit.
I wonder if a response to your concern and or is that once the Department of Homeland Security got this information, maybe that at that point, their response is where the disconnect happens. Maybe they would say, okay, why are you a private company? Why are you giving us this information? Why are you bothering to compile all this information? Mm-hmm. If we wanted it, we would have gone out and gotten it, or we would have asked you to get it. At that point, maybe that's where I think the story would be a lot less creepy if the Department of Homeland Security would have gotten the information and then been like, okay, thanks, but no thanks.
I agree with you. It is very weird that a company would decide to compile something so specific as this and then take it to the government and the government accepts it. I agree with you. It's getting into very creepy territory, but you know, again, it's a really, really hard and awful truth that we're having to face. It's something that I think we're going to reckon with in the next 5 to 10 years is what do we now consider private and public? Since almost all of our public information, I mean, private information seems to be public. What do we truly consider private and public? And I think we're really going to need to start really grappling with that and getting some legislation out there to say, hey, this is now what we mean by private and public, and we are not going to allow this information to be used in this manner. But as of right now, it's just a really, really sticky ethical question that, again, we're going to have to really reckon with in the next decade, you know?
Yeah, well, excellent points, Jared. Thanks so much for calling in from Lakeland with that point and bringing maybe an idea or a consciousness to ourselves about how much we share. And I should remind people that if you missed it a few weeks ago, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago on Alternative Radio, which we play on Alternative alternate Tuesdays at 10 in the morning, there was a speaker, and I can't recall her name, I apologize, but she's a professor up in the Northeast somewhere, and she wrote a book recently called The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, and it talks about how all of our information is being used and gathered, and her thesis is that these companies are using our information that we freely give them in order to predict our future behaviors. And it's a huge book, and you can go back and listen to alternativeradio.org has this this speech, or you can find a library or a bookstore that has Age of Surveillance Capitalism if you'd like to learn more. So thanks Jared for that call, and we'll go now to John in Palmetto. And John, I'm told that you have a story about Ronald Reagan at Berkeley.
There's a couple documentaries that cite it, but Ronald Reagan gave the order to shoot, was governor of California at Berkeley, when they took over the park for, I think it was over 6 weeks, might have been 8 or 9 weeks, and they went in and attempted to move everybody out a couple of times, but he gave the order to shoot them if they had to, but they took the bulldozers in. And they just pretty much went along, and if anything was left, you know, they just destroyed everything. But in Kent State, the order was given, too. They denied that. They denied that. They said that somebody shouted one thing instead of something else, and that's why they fired. But considering the, I think it was 20-some shots that were fired, it was just so many that hit kids, you know.
Are you talking about in Berkeley?
No, I'm talking about, I'm going also in Kent State. As far as giving the order to shoot, as a gentleman about three calls back, I just came in late on it, but as far as giving the okay to shoot students or to shoot the protesters, he was talking about they had an order in Tampa. As a reporter, I was covering that, and I heard that back then because I went up there from Manatee County, and I did notice something different than any place else. I didn't quite get the full story, but I noticed everybody was really on edge there in Tampa. You know, it was unlike the marches and the occupiers and surrounding communities. They were pretty much that had a different flavor to it, and I think it is because they tried to nip it in the bud, and they did get quite rough with a lot of them, and I'm sure there was a few of them violated. But, I was just dealing with this. Trump, he's going to, he wouldn't hesitate to start a war, whether it's in Iran or it's in Venezuela. And he can shut everything down, all investigations, everything, when he takes that executive order to do that. And he can postpone the hearings. He can do all that stuff. It's the only way he can do it. So, you know, I've been watching. I'm on the approach to MacDill, and I've been watching Tomcats go in packs of six. I've been watching transport, C-130s, C-45s, all kinds of. You can tell something's going on. I've been living here for many years, and never like it is now. So we're getting ready for Venezuela. You know, I think where the gun is cocked. It's just they haven't put it on trigger yet.
All right. Thank you for that insight, John. And yeah, I mean, Secretary Pompeo and others have said all options are on the table. And when reporters ask follow-ups, they say something to the effect of, oh, wait, are you meaning an invasion, a military invasion? They're saying all options are on the table. So who knows? It could happen. Also, the U.S. Maybe I could use the word aggressive in the Persian Gulf with sending another aircraft fleet to aircraft carrier and the associated war machinery to the Persian Gulf, because they say that Iran is going to threaten U.S. troops. So it looks like the U.S. might be gearing up for, you know, skirmishes at least with Iran. So yeah, all that is stuff to watch. So thanks for giving us the report from the skies over MacDill Air Force Base in South Tampa from Palmetto. Thanks, John. And Rob writes in from the newsroom. He says, Pointer published a list of 515 unreliable news sites on April 30th, then took down the list from its website a few days later. It received negative pushback by many conservative outlets that were on the list. And so far, WMNF cannot determine that The Intercept was or was not on that list of 515. So thank you, Rob, for that information. That's maybe why I couldn't find it. I feel a little less scatterbrained for not being able to find it, because it isn't there. So thank you for that. Let's read this comment from Adam, who writes, The Intercept is pretty good. I respect their reporting. The only bad thing about them is Glenn Greenwald. He's gone off the deep end trying to downplay the Mueller report because of all his bad takes on it previously. Well, that's what Adam says. And I agree with him that, well, I would say that Glenn Greenwald definitely is very adamant that the Mueller report is not any kind of smoking gun. He's been on Democracy Now! Speaking at length about that. So Adam calls that bad takes. So what do you think? We could talk about the Mueller report if we'd like. But thank you, for Adam, for that. Let's go now to David in Clearwater. And David asks, are we going to war?
Hey, how are you?
Doing great. What's on your mind?
I'm just getting ready to go to war with somebody who wanted to cut in my lane, but I'm going to let him go ahead. About 3 weeks ago, the news was interesting, and I started talking to my friends and saying, I think I'll start a pool. I think I'll start a pool that we're betting on whether we go to war with South America or with Iran or where, because it's sort of one of those things that happens. When we get close to an election and there are no major wars that are going on, anybody in the White House, Republican, starts a war. And so I thought that was pretty funny, but it's going to scare me now. I don't know what's going on as far as all of this saber wielding by our chicken hawk military advisors to a obviously chicken hawk president, somebody that's never been to war, never seen anybody die, and thinks that's a wonderful thing for the economy.
Wag the Dog is the film that comes to mind. Although, you know, a lot of people said that Clinton, that was what was in Clinton's mind when, you know, the U.S. had military incursions into the Balkans in the 90s. So it's not just Republicans necessarily.
Whoever's in power that wants to stay in power. I couldn't believe that President Bush got reelected after the first term, but he did. And went all the way down to, about a month before he was out of office, he sat down and said, oh, by the way, we're bankrupt. I vote. I don't know what it means, but I vote. Yeah. I haven't voted on the right side in the last four or five two elections.
All right, you got to try harder, David. Pick the winning person next time.
No. Well, I don't know. I could say an awful lot if I don't pick the winning person, and they're as idiotic as a lot of our policies seem to be.
All right, David, I'm going to move on. Thanks. I hope everyone in your pool loses their bets. Everyone, all of them. So thanks for that, David. In Clearwater, let's go on to John in St. Pete. Hi, John. You want to talk about government surveillance?
I find it interesting that all these genealogy companies that people give their DNA to are suddenly, helping solve crimes. So it makes me wonder, where does that DNA stuff go once you send it in?
Yeah, my understanding is that the companies that you give your money to and your DNA to, they now own all that information and they can do whatever they want with it. I mean, that's my understanding. They probably have some sort of disclosure forms that you sign and that there's some sort of limitations. But in general, if they want to, you could go as far as you want with this, but if they want to clone you or something, they own that information now, is my understanding.
That's very interesting that people voluntarily, not only volunteer, but they pay for it too, just to give this away. It's the essence of who you are. Also, as far as Donald Trump and the war thing, I believe it's Bolton that's running everything. And he's a notorious hawk, and he would like to attack somebody somewhere. He said that. So, I think Bolton's going to influence something in the bad way. And unfortunately, I think we're going to attack somebody.
Yeah, John Bolton.
Venezuela.
Venezuela is a sitting duck target very close by. That's true. But, you know, John Bolton has really, really, really been itching for war with Iran for a long time. And he partially gets that when the proxies for Iran in Yemen. But, you know, I don't know. It just seems
I'm old enough to remember the Gulf of Tonkin incident that really got us involved in Vietnam, which is really a staged event that happened with one of our warships, a small one, and it sucked us further and deeper down the Vietnam tube. So I'm looking for some kind of an incident, whether it's a small boat attacks our aircraft carrier or something like that, and that'll set it off. So that's all I got to say. Thanks.
All right, thank you so much for that call, John. And I want to thank everyone who's been involved in this conversation so far about surveillance of protesters. And I'm going to move on right now just because I think we've played that one out. Thank you to everyone who participated in that. And thank you especially to my guest, Ryan Devereaux, who wrote those articles and was a guest on the show to talk about the private company that gave its information about protests that were happening last summer to the Department of Homeland Security. Well, let's now go to Tallahassee. And one of the big issues that I hope didn't get lost in the shuffle, there was so much news going on last week in Tallahassee, so many bills passed, a couple failed, the budget was passed, and so forth. But Amendment 4 was a huge issue that I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle. And a reporter at WFSU, the NPR affiliate in Tallahassee, did an interview with the ACLU of Florida. And so about Amendment 4 and about how the bill the legislature passed. So we're going to play that. It's a little bit long right now, too long for me to play in the afternoon headlines. So I'm going to get to it right now. And if there should be a little bit of time afterwards if you want to weigh in on this as well. Last fall, 5.1 million Floridians voted to give felons who've completed their sentences and did not commit a felony sexual assault or murder their voting rights back. But last week, the Florida legislature passed a bill that added more hurdles on how felons would go about getting their voting rights restored. Supporters of the bill, mostly Republicans, believe terms like completion of sentence, murder, and sexual felony offense all needed to be defined. WFSU's Blaise Ganey spoke with the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida's Kirk Bailey about why they oppose the bill.
The Senate Bill 7066. It was amended Thursday night to add in implementing language for Amendment 4. Can you tell me the ACLU's thoughts on this amendment?
Thank you, Blaise. I think the trouble with this legislation is our view is that the legislature has just created the same roadblocks that were in place when returning citizens had to go through the clemency process to get their rights restored. So the bill essentially creates more delays and assures denials to the right to vote for people who we think are eligible under Amendment 4. The bill is too broad, and the offenses that it defines are as being excluded for individuals who still aren't eligible to vote. And it requires too much in terms of their payment of civil monetary obligations before their terms of sentence are deemed complete. And all that we don't think is consistent with Amendment 4.
All right, now another part of the bill talks about the financial obligations and what they must do, felons that is, to complete them. They can either pay them in full, they can have a victim or the court forgive them for the restitution, or if a judge allows, a felon can then serve community service in lieu of payment. Now, do you all see this as a jurisdictional nightmare where felons could go to Orange County and have to do less community service maybe than a judge in Okaloosa County who may feel differently about a sentence?
Yeah, we definitely do have concerns that this legislation will be confusing and implemented in different ways in different jurisdictions, and that it'll have a disparate impact on individuals, both in its overall scope, but it'll have an unequal impact in how it's implemented around the state. Frankly, it seems to us to be administratively impossible to implement the way legislators described it, and that's why I think our view is it's assured to mean denials of the right to vote for people who are otherwise eligible.
And great. And I know instead of paying off, they can have that transferred into community service hours. And a question was asked on the floor earlier, on the House floor, about whether or not there would be an equation that would be mapped out to say X amount of hours equals X amount of dollars. The rebuttal to that from Representative Grant was that each county has their own equation that they go off of. Now, from my understanding, that there by itself automatically makes it unconstitutional, where we're going different county by county to have different ways that a person will be able to get their rights back. Is that the same way that the ACLU sees it?
Yeah, you know, I'll admit we're still evaluating all of the different the problems with this bill, but you certainly identified one that's going to be problematic if it leads to different treatment of different individuals in different counties who are otherwise similarly situated. The amendment was designed to create a standard statewide, and because of the operation of legislation that the legislature has put in place, that doesn't turn out to be the case, it's going to present serious constitutional problems.
If it does present constitutional problems, from where I sit, I'm used to seeing, you know, people challenge this. Is that what ACLU, or have you heard of anybody expecting to do that now that it just passed less than an hour ago? But I'd imagine those talks would have already started.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. I mean, we usually don't comment on litigation before we actually file it, which is, you know, many organizations do the same. We've obviously been evaluating these bills as they've gone through the process and asking ourselves what problems they present. We're continuing to do that, and I think we'll evaluate whether or not and on what grounds we might file litigation. Obviously, we wouldn't do that before the governor signs it. But that's definitely being considered. I would expect that's going to be the case. We and many others have observed that there are numerous unconstitutional provisions in the various bills that have purported to implement Amendment 4, and you know, now we're at that stage in the process where we have to make some of those decisions and go forward in the coming days and weeks.
And going forward, do you think that, I mean, it's hard to tell, but medical marijuana was also a constitutional amendment, and that took about 3 to 4 years to get fully implemented the way that the voters' intent was. And many would say that it still isn't really up to what the voters' intent was today. Do you see this as another problem that may take years to get right, seeing as the legislature only meets for 3 months out of every year?
I do think it's possible that this is going to take us some time to sort out. The one thing I will say about Amendment 4, however, is that it was clear and unambiguous. That was a position that the Florida Supreme Court took in terms of describing the language of Amendment 4. It's certainly our view that it is much clearer on its face in its language than other constitutional amendments have been. I'm not speaking specifically to medical marijuana, but it's a very small, Amendment 4 was a very small amendment. It's just a little bit of language that sets out the standard for when folks should have their eligibility to vote restored. And so in that sense, I think the debate will be more focused, but it's going to take the time it takes if it ends up in litigation or if we have to come back to the legislature next year to try to remove some of these provisions that are undermining the amendment. It's definitely going to take some time.
Well, that's the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida's Kirk Bailey talking with WFSU's Blaze Ganey about Amendment 4. And a bill was passed in the Florida legislature last week. Some people are saying that it implements a poll tax on people getting their rights restored, ex-felons getting their rights restored. Now they have to pay back the fees from the court fees and so forth before they get their rights back. Well, thank you to everyone who has called and emailed and texted today. And I want to thank our guests, Ryan Devereaux from The Intercept and Glenn McKeel, the spokesperson for Citizens Against Roselli Dog Park in Treasure Island. And if you'd like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts about any of the topics that we talked about today, give me a call at 813 888-238-8001, extension 114, and I'll play your message next show. You can also join the conversation online at WMNF.org/news or on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at WMNF News. I want to thank our engineers Alvaro Montealegre and Frank Knox. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero Mark Bureau will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned now for Executive Session with John Gilmore coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa.